Welcome to SuccessfulSavior.org, the ministry of Harmony Primitive Baptist Church in Donaldson, Arkansas. This is Elder Dan Sammons preaching in our regular Sunday morning service.
I do have a thought on my mind today, and Brother Sonny Bonner came up to me this morning and said, "What are you going to preach on today?" And I'm kind of tried to think about how to characterize the message I have for you. Pray the Lord pulls all this together. I'm going to start in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 11. The question I'm going to set on your mind before I read that is, what's the difference between he and we? What is the difference between he and we? Well, it's enormous, and it may not be exactly what you think it is. It's far more than just the spelling. There are theological ramifications to the distinction between he and we, and much confusion is bred in the domain of Christianity about the understanding of what he shall do and what we must do and what the purpose of those doings is. So it's important that we be clear on it. I'm in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 11. We find this: "It is a faithful saying, for if we be dead with him, we shall also live with him. If we suffer, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he also will deny us. If we believe not, yet he abideth faithful. He cannot deny himself." That is truly one of the most comforting verses for the child of God in the Bible. Thank you for that. Anyone who has a sober view of their own performance in righteousness and their efforts to follow the Lord Jesus Christ as disciples is going to find a lot of flaws in that. And, you know, if we change the he in that verse to a we, it would be incredibly discouraging, would it not? If we believe not, yet we abideth faithful, we can't deny ourselves. That's not going to give you much comfort. Because if you look at your life, you're going to say, I haven't abideth faithful in all things at all times. I'm struggling to abide faithful. I'm struggling to do what the Lord would have me to do. It feels like it's a battle. I'm fighting the old man, trying to put on the new man. Every day is a struggle. It's a struggle. And I can't really have this confidence in my own faithfulness. And in fact, this verse is trying to provide some comfort to us of the form that though you are not perfect and though you don't do everything and you're not as faithful as you should be, God abideth faithful. His faithfulness in the things that he has promised to his people is perfect and it cannot fail. So while you may look at yourself and see many failings, if you were basing your hope strictly on that, you'd have no hope. You'd either have no hope or you'd have no sense. You follow me? Because you'd be so senseless as to think that what you did was good enough to have hope in. That's not the truth. And so this verse is trying to encourage us about the faithfulness of God. Even when we fall short and we fail and we're faithless, God's people are resting upon the fact that He abideth faithful, not that we abideth faithful. Now there's a problem in that. Our faithfulness is very important to our lives. It's just not that upon which your eternal salvation and hope is resting. But it's very important to our lives, and we shouldn't make the mistake of saying, well, because He abideth faithful, our faithfulness there does not matter. It doesn't matter in terms of where you'll spend eternity, but it matters greatly to your life and to your profitability in the kingdom of God, right? So we don't want to go too far afield on this, but I think you see right there's a distinction between he and we. You put the we where the he is there, and you don't have anything to be confident in. And unless he is in that place of the one who abideth faithful, we don't have any hope at all, because we are so often not faithful in our lives, and we know that. So what is the difference between he and we? Well, it's not just one letter. Right? It's not just simply a matter of spelling. And I'll put it like this: the difference between he and we is grace. Grace is the difference between he and we. It's the grace of God wherein He abideth faithful that we have our confidence in, right? And if it had to be in us, in the we, then your salvation would not be a matter of grace, would it? It would be a matter of what you do, be a matter of works. So the distinction between He and we is grace in that context, and it's important that we keep that in mind. So I'm thinking about examples of how people are and how we are with respect to the truths and the challenges we have in our lives. And I wanted to go back and look at Exodus chapter 14, which is a very, very popular Bible story. We all know it very well. It's the story of the crossing of the Red Sea. It's an example of He abideth faithful. And I want to try to draw something out of this lesson. It's such a common and known Bible story that I want to try not to dwell so much on the events. I think everybody knows the events that occurred in this chapter. Probably heard it many times. I want to try to focus more on the attitudes of the people as an example to us and the application that this might have in our own lives. Well, starting in verse 1, chapter 14, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel that they turn and encamp before Pihahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal Zephon. Before it shall ye encamp by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, They are entangled in the land. The wilderness hath shut them in." Now, this is Pharaoh viewing the situation where the Israelites have left Egypt. He has let them go. But upon further consideration, as you know the story, he decided, well, I don't really want to let them go. Let's go get them. Let's go bring them back. So he's pursuing them, and through the carnal eye, which is the way typically things are seen, he says, well, they've got themselves in a bind here. They are entangled in the land. The wilderness hath shut them in. They are in a place where they got nowhere to run, nowhere to turn. And that's true if all you're looking at the circumstances through is the carnal eye. Verse 4, "And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that he shall follow after them, and I will be honored upon Pharaoh and upon all his hosts, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord." And they did so. Now, I think there's two senses in which these circumstances would teach the Egyptians that God is the Lord. And I believe both of them are in play in this lesson. If you look at Isaiah 26 and verse 10, it's a passage I used to quote all the time, and I've kind of forgotten about it, and it came to mind as I was studying this. And I think it's such an important passage because it speaks to the total depravity of man and helps you understand why salvation has to be by the grace of God, because this is the disposition of the wicked. It says, Isaiah 26:10, "Let favor be showed to the wicked, yet will he not learn righteousness?" Now that is completely contrary to the philosophy of ministry of many in Christendom today. If the arrangement is you must tell some dreadfully lost, unregenerate person the gospel so that they can become born again, there's nothing more favorable to do for someone like that who's in that state of unregenerate wickedness than to share the gospel with them, if that's the appropriate arrangement, right? Because you could possibly get them eternally saved under that arrangement. Show them the favor, do them a favor, right? Here's this dead alien sinner, do him a favor, this wicked man, and through that, he's going to become born again. In some respects, that's a pretty good general description of the way much of Christianity regards the gospel and the utility of the gospel. Go out and do people the favor of sharing the gospel with them and you'll get them born again. Okay? But what does Isaiah say about the wicked? Isaiah's statement affirms the total depravity of man. He completely shuts the door on this idea of doing someone the favor of sharing them the gospel so that they might be eternally saved. "Let favor be showed to the wicked, yet will he not learn righteousness." See what I'm saying? Much of the world is saying, show them the favor of the gospel and they will learn righteousness thereby. That's exactly the opposite of what Isaiah is saying. Because a totally depraved, wicked man cannot receive gospel truth. Now, that doesn't mean you don't share the gospel with people. It also doesn't mean that you go around thinking, well, I sort of know who's wicked and who's not, who's regenerate and who's not. You don't know that. So you do share the gospel, but you share it so that those, as the Lord said, who have ears to hear may hear it and profit from it. And that's the Lord's business there. Let favor be showed to the wicked, yet will he not learn righteousness. In the land of uprightness will he deal unjustly and will not behold the majesty of the Lord. So the abject unregenerate who are in Egypt, of which I'm sure there were many, they're going to hear this story of how God defeated the Egyptian army. And in some sense, they're going to know that God is the Lord. Now, they may not believe in that God. They may not serve Him. They may not love Him or whatever. They are going to at least recognize, well, we had the most powerful army in the world. And they went up against these Egyptian people, and supposedly their God destroyed our army. And the evidence for that is going to be irrefutable. You can't make an army disappear and not have people take notice. So the evidence that's going to be set forth that God is the Lord, the evidence that existed in the temporal world at this time would have been absolutely irrefutable. Whether these people were regenerate men and believed on God in the spiritual sense or not, the evidence of God being God would have been irrefutable. So in that sense, those people would have been shown there's something going on there. Maybe there's something to what these people are saying, whether they actually believed it or not in a spiritual sense. But you know what? I think there were people in Egypt who were shown this in another sense. Now, I can't prove that in terms of the Egyptian people, but I can prove that this testimony resonated with some people when they heard it in a spiritual sense. And let's look at that right quick. Joshua chapter 2, verse 9 through 11. Look at what Rahab the harlot says to the spies who she was harboring in her house. I know that the Lord hath given you the land, and that your terror has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when ye came out of Egypt, and what you did under the two kings of the Amorites on the other side of Jordan. In verse 11, she said, and as soon as we heard these things, our hearts did melt. Neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you, for the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and in earth beneath. Now, we know from the Bible's testimony something about Rahab. This is not just Rahab saying, well, we know that something happened and the Egyptian army disappeared. I don't really believe in your God, but we don't know where that army is, and we really, really know what happened, and it appears to be some sort of display of power. It's not that sort of affirmation. Rahab is hearing this with a spiritual ear. She heard tell of this thing, and she believed in this God and said, that is the God of this world, heaven above and earth below. So I believe some people, certainly in this subsequent account, but I believe there are people in Egypt as well. Indeed, there are people of every kindred, tongue, and people and nation, are there not, who are God's people. I don't doubt for a moment that there were Egyptian people who were regenerate, who heard this and maybe had seen things going on in Israel, and they were like, you know, I'm stuck in this hostile totalitarian regime under the brutalities of Pharaoh, but those Israelites are serving the true and living God. And I'm sure that they were encouraged by that testimony. I don't have any doubt about that, though I can't definitively prove that there was any particular Egyptian who felt that way. And I think those two things are in play. Going back to verse 5. And it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and of his servants was turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? And he made ready his chariot and took his people with him, and he took 600 chosen chariots and all the chariots of Egypt and captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued after the children of Israel, and after the children of Israel went out with an high hand. But the Egyptians pursued after them all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them encamping by the sea. beside Pihahiroth and before Baal-Zephon. God hardened Pharaoh's heart in this, and I think for us to have a proper understanding, we've got to handle this carefully. God did not force Pharaoh to commit sin. God does not do that. And this is where many people jump the tracks with the doctrine of predestination. Rather than relegating predestination, which that English word is used exclusively with respect to the matters of eternal salvation in our Bible, rather than keeping it in that domain, they extend it to every single thing that ever happens. And they believe God has predestined or ordained or essentially forced Pharaoh by decree to commit sin and rebel against him. Well, I submit to you, if that is the case, then God is a house set against himself. Jesus Christ said such a thing cannot stand. So I think to understand God's ordinances and God's decrees, you must maintain a division between that which God does and that which God permits to be done. We are creatures that have a will, and fallen man has an evil will. That's a result of man's actions, not God's actions. The Bible clearly places the blame for the entry of sin into humanity upon an act of disobedience on the part of man. Not a matter of God forced this man to do this by an unalterable divine decree. Okay? So that's important to know, lest we have God forcing every evil act that ever occurred in this life, God causing that to happen. That's a horrific idea if you will really let yourself enter into it. What's the most heinous and horrible thing you can think that takes place in this world? Whatever that is, we all have different ideas. There's plenty of horrible examples in history. To think that God made that person do that is a dreadful idea, theologically. It has implications that we cannot abide, because God is light and in Him is no darkness at all. So that it can't be reconciled with that. Nevertheless, we do find that God permits His creation to rebel against Him. He has permitted His creation. He has allowed them to sin against Him. I don't have a problem with saying God decreed that He was going to allow such things. That from the beginning, He said, yeah, I'm going to let that happen. I don't think anything sneaks up on God. So I think God had to at least say, I'm going to let those things happen. But that doesn't make Him the author of those things. It also doesn't mean He doesn't have dominion over those things. Dominion involves both having the ability to act and also allowing others to act as well, if you so choose. True dominion means I'm going to let you do this if you want to, right? If you've allowed your children to do something, maybe they have persisted in some form of disobedience and they're about to do it again and you just let them do it. Are you saying, well, I abdicate my dominion over you? No, you still have dominion over them, but you have chosen to exercise that dominion in a very particular way, perhaps to illustrate to them the folly of their disobedience. You said, all right, this time I'm going to let you do it. I'm not abdicating my dominion at all. I'm exercising my dominion in a very particular way, a permissive way, with the intent of making a demonstration or a lesson out of it. So it's important that we recognize God's not forcing Pharaoh to do this. You take a wicked person and remove the constraints of circumstance, is that person going to be more wicked in their expression of things, or are they going to be less wicked? Are they going to suddenly start serving God? You take someone who has a carnal and wicked heart and you give them $10,000, are they going to immediately go out and give that to their next door neighbor who needs help with getting a new roof on their house or something like that? The wicked and carnal heart of men, once you remove constraints, it follows its natural course, right? The Bible talks about the dog returns to his vomit. Now, those of you who are dog owners recognize that disgusting little attribute of having a dog. It's a part of their nature. It's totally gross, but that's just what they do because it's part of their nature. And so wickedness, apart from the grace of God, likewise inclines men to follow their nature. God doesn't have to make somebody who's wicked do something wicked. They'll do it on their own, given the opportunity. And God's not forcing them to do it. Okay, so God didn't force Pharaoh to do this, though it does say he hardened his heart. Well, yeah, I mean, the practice of sin will harden your heart. The more wickedness people practice and the more they pursue these things, the greater their hardness of heart becomes, right? Very evident. I mean, you see it all around you. I'm trying to think of an example that I can share that take a woman. We'll try to prove this point. I hope you'll bear with it. You take a woman who finds herself in a circumstance where she decides she's going to sell her body. Okay? Now, whatever normal conscience people have about that, I would think that in the initial instance of that, it would be very, very troubling. You would feel very, very bad about it. But scroll ahead, and now this woman has done this for 20 years. Is she going to have the same sensitivity to that sin that she had the first time she ever committed it? Or is she going to be callous to this? And is there going to, will the last 20 years have fostered in her a hardness of heart where she's just so callous to it, she's like, it doesn't really bother me anymore. And frankly, I think it's that big of a deal. That happens all the time. And it happens across 1,000 different sins that are out there. It doesn't have to be prostitution. It can be any number of sins. And as they're practiced over time, we develop a hardness of heart. The practice of sin hardens the heart. So the fact that God hardened his heart, all God had to do is say, okay, I'm going to let you go with the way you want to go. I'm going to let you follow your own inclinations. And that alone is going to harden Pharaoh's heart. Okay, so forgive me for running that rabbit trail, but it felt important. So verse 10, and when Pharaoh drew nigh and the children of Israel lifted up their eyes and behold, the Egyptians marched after them and they were sore afraid and the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. And they said unto Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. That is an absolutely horrible attitude. Horrible attitude. Paul says these are in samples. So what's the lesson you can get out of that? You can have an absolutely horrible attitude. You can have been only a short time previously been miraculously delivered with an evident show of the power of God. And just a short time later, you're in another spot that seems difficult. And you're not thinking about miraculous deliverances at all. You're just thinking, this is awful. I'd have been better off if I'd have died before. And I'm going to wear out the spiritual leader here about, why are you trying to drag us along this path here? We'd have been better off just if you just left us alone. Horrible attitude. Hard to look at. Harder to apply because it applies to us. It's an evidence of how quickly we lose sight of God's deliverances in our lives and we begin thinking about something else. We soon forget these things and it's troubling. It's troubling, but it gives you an opportunity to say, well, where do I see that attitude in my own life? All of us are alive here right now. We've had deliverances temporally to get us into this room this morning. Innumerable ones. More than you remember. More than you remember. So the evidence that God has delivered us time and again is in your very presence of being here. So we need to keep that in mind. God has delivered us many times before, and He will continue. He said He didn't ever leave us nor forsake us, and we need to keep that in mind. So, terrible attitude, but Moses has a response here. And Moses said unto the people, fear ye not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which He will show to you today. For the Egyptians whom ye have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forever. Now there's literally no way you could enter into that promise without believing we're about to see a miracle take place here. You got this ragtag group that's going through, has left Egyptian bondage. They're carrying a bunch of stuff with them. And now you've got the greatest army in the world coming up against them. There's not a natural means whereby you're going to say, we're going to defeat this enemy. Okay, we're going to toughen up here and we're going to get our heads on straight and we're going to fight this Egyptian army. If you're going to believe what's being said here, he says, stand still, does he not? Which evidently makes it clear that this is not going to be a result of you doing any fighting. It's not going to be a we fight. It's going to be a he fight. Follow me? See the difference between a we and a he? It's an enormous difference. Very important. And this is a timely salvation. And this shows the sovereignty of God over things. The Lord shall fight for you, and ye shall hold your peace. That's a he fight, not a we fight. God's going to get you out of this. Now, this next verse is funny to me. And the Lord said unto Moses, wherefore criest thou unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel that they go forward. That strikes me as funny. They're in this situation, and it almost feels like the Lord's saying, don't talk to me about it. I'm providing that. Get these people to go. I'm going to make this happen. Tell them to follow through with what I'm going to provide for them. But lift thou up thy rod and stretch out thine hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians that they shall follow them. And I will get me honor upon Pharaoh and upon all his hosts, upon his chariots and upon his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. Well, there it is again, right? They're going to know it. Whether there's some in that company that come to know it in a spiritual sense because they're spiritual people, or whether they just know it through the irrefutable evidence of their own defeat, which was miraculous, they're going to know it in one way or the other. When I have gotten me honor upon Pharaoh and upon his chariots and upon his horsemen. Verse 19, and the angel of God which went before the camp of Israel removed and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud went from before their face and stood behind them. And it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel, and it was a cloud and a darkness to them, but it gave light by night to these, so that the one came not near the other all the night. That is God as your rear ward. Now that word is in the Bible in a few places. I'll give you an example. Isaiah 53 and verse 12 has an example of that. It's kind of a strange looking word, and it's easy to mispronounce it as a result of the way it's spelled, but Isaiah 52 and verse 12. For ye shall not go out with haste, nor go by flight, for the Lord will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rear ward. R-E-R-E-W-A-R-D, which looks like re-reward, right? If you think of it not as reward, which kind of jumps out at you, just see that last word, ward. The R-E-R-E is rear. What that means is God's got your back, okay? That's how we would say it in our parlance. God has got your back. You move forward, God's watching your back and making sure you don't get attacked from the rear. And that's exactly what happened here in Exodus. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. It's really important that you recognize the Bible's full of miracles like this. And it's been very popular in recent years. The phrase comes up a lot. You found it a lot in COVID, for example. You'd hear people saying the phrase, follow the science. And then that could mean any number of things based on what someone says the science is, right? It could be any number of things. But this mantra gets repeated over and again. We need to follow the science. Well, the problem with that, as it comes to your Christian walk, is that the world is not composed entirely of natural things. The Christian faith embraces that there is a bigger reality than simply the nature that surrounds us. There's a spiritual world. The natural world is a creation of God that is under His dominion. But the totality of all things that have ever come to pass cannot be contained within that domain of natural things. It's very important that Christian people embrace that truth, because the moment you allow follow the science to creep into your Christianity, you're being pressed into a box of naturalism. And the Christian faith will not fit in that box. God is spirit. He is a supernatural, all-powerful being. He created the domain of nature, and He has dominion over it, which means He can transcend what we regard as the rules of nature. So it's really important. This is a really important point, and I feel like some people object to it and say, well, but don't we follow the science in some things? Well, we should follow the science in many things. But there's also, the Bible reports of something that's called science falsely so-called. So it's a little bit more fuzzy on determining what the science is in scientific things, and we have to be aware of that. But let me give you the thing that I find problematic about this and why I think it's important for Christian people to affirm the miracles of the Bible and that God is a supernatural God. If you buy into follow the science, which in a secular society is going to be applied to everything, not just to the domain of some acute matter of pandemic illness. If you take that mantra and start applying it elsewhere, how is follow the science going to reconcile with the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead? You follow me? That's an enormously important point, and you may not see it now because, well, I'm thinking about it as it relates to COVID or as it relates to what my doctor told me about how I should recuperate from a surgery or whatever. Well, maybe in those things, maybe that it's good, maybe it's not, I don't know. But if you take it as a universal truism, the moment you step out of that domain and start applying it to other areas of life, you've got a big problem with Christianity. The fundamental truths of the Christian faith do not follow the science. You don't have creation out of nothing based on science. There's no experimental test you could do that can prove that something could be created out of nothing. You follow me? By the way, how would you set up the test? Right? You'd have to start with something that has nothing. Now, how are you going to do that? I mean, it's ludicrous. So, creation out of nothing by a spirit, God, who's all powerful, that's not the science. That's the Bible. It's the Word of God. Virgins do not give birth. Okay? Amen. You follow the science, well, then you're going to have to stop preaching the virgin birth. Because that's not the science. And we all said we're going to follow the science. Well, where does that go? Not only should we follow the science, we should also start identifying people who are not following the science, and we're going to call them disinformation, and we're going to censor them and make it criminal for them to say the things that don't follow the science, because follow the science is our universal mantra. I'm telling you, Christianity can't fit into this box. And while there may be things in this life that we need to follow good science on, the Christian religion is supernatural. And it's important that we embrace it. You can't have creation out of nothing, the virgin birth, the resurrection from the dead. Those are big, big issues in the Christian faith. And you don't get there with science. You get there with God. It's very important. This is a miraculous intervention here. And there's been a lot of ink spilled over the years of people trying to explain away, well, how could this have happened naturally? You don't have to do that. Because it's supernatural, right? God has control over this. That's absolutely fundamental to the Christian faith. Well, I see my time's getting on. Let me wrap this up. You know the story. They got across. Said the water was like a wall on either side. That's a miracle, okay? That's a miracle. And while there's language in here, it talks about the wind blowing and those sorts of things. Okay. I don't doubt that that's true, but it's still a miracle. There may be all sorts of things that attended it that were naturalistic and evident, but the water standing up as a wall and those people walking forth on dry land, which is the clear testimony, that's a miracle. That didn't come about through some manipulation of natural laws. It came about by God, who is sovereign over all things, saying, that's what I want the water to do, and it did it. Important that we know that. So, the Egyptians, they kind of fall into their demise as a result of this. Amazing that these people could see this evident miracle before them and still not think, well, there's like a miracle working God that's on their side. I'm not going in there. I'm not going after them. Went right in to their own demise. It says something about the hardness of hearts and the inability to see an evident spiritual miracle when it's right in front of them. Chapter 15 is the song of Moses. It's this recounting, you know, what happened. It's a song. We should probably set it to, I'm sure someone set it to music, and we should probably sing it sometime. But he sort of retells the story here of how God delivered them, and it is a miraculous deliverance that he wanted to capture in song. But the one thing I want to pick up as we close here is after he sort of gives this song, retelling of these miraculous events, things that he did rather than that we did, God's deliverance of them, we find this testimony at the end of this chapter. And Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a timbrel in her hand, and the women went out after her with timbrels and with dances. And Miriam answered them, saying, "Sing ye to the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he hath thrown into the sea." So Miriam's got a song she wrote too, and she's singing it. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. You're 3 days later. These people just walked through the Red Sea in a miraculous display of God's sovereign power and then watched him destroy the greatest army on earth before their very eyes. And 3 days later, this is where they are. I'm thirsty. Never mind that parting the Red Sea and destroying the Egyptian army. I'm thirsty. Now, what's the lesson we're going to get out of that? When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah, which means bitter, by the way. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" 3 days later, they were murmuring before, "Oh, we're caught, you know, how are we going to get out of this? Moses, you should have left us in Egypt to die. We'd have been better off if you just left us there. Look what you've done. This is awful." Miraculous deliverance. Totally inconceivable that they could have been delivered in this. And 3 days later, they're thirsty and they're murmuring again. The lesson in this is just, you know, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. The Bible says that. But the thing I want to ask is, how are we hardening our own hearts? How hard are our hearts if we can think back over the deliverances we've had time and again and time and again? And we get 3 days into a situation where we're suffering a little bit and we're thinking, "I'm going to murmur about this and complain about it." I mean, we just really, honestly, if we're thinking rightly about things, we don't have anything to complain about. And I'm not coming down on you on that because I think you're uniquely expressing it. I'm telling you that because I'm uniquely expressing it. I see all too often in myself, it's almost this thing where everybody kind of has to have something to be complaining about, right? And even if things are pretty well going okay, I still feel like I got to have something I can be complaining about. It's convicting to me. It makes me think I need to complain less. I need to thank God more and complain less. I need to trust God more and doubt Him less. These things are written for in samples to us, and I think that's part of the lesson here. You see it time and again in the history of Israel. You know, they just keep going back to these things, and I think that's how we are, and it's intended to teach us. When we see these examples, I think we're apt to be really hard on the Egyptians because they had this miraculous deliverance, and maybe our deliverances have not been as seemingly miraculous. So we think, well, surely they should have known, but God's delivering us as well. And we murmur too much. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And he cried to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. And when he cast it into the waters were made sweet. There he made for them a statue and an ordinance, and there he proved them. And said, "If thou wilt diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God, and wilt do that which is right in his sight, and will give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon thee, which I have brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord that healeth thee." We go through life, we have our trials and our difficulties. We murmur, we do it too much, We're too forgetful of the things where God has delivered us in the past. And we come to this place where there's bitter waters and we're apt to start complaining again. But Christ is that branch that's thrown into the water that makes it sweet. That's the way we have to think about these things. You have to think about them not in terms of how they appear to be on the horizontal plane and difficult. Yeah, you're going to have difficulties. But God has fixed these things. He has made it so that He's going to provide for us that which we need. And He said He'll never leave us nor forsake us. And those are things that He's going to do, not that we're going to do. And we should take our confidence and hope in that. God's going to deliver us. Though we're going to have some difficulties, maybe we should focus more on how God has delivered us to date and be more faithful in how we think about God's deliverances of us in the future.
Thank you for listening to SuccessfulSavior.org, the ministry of Harmony Primitive Baptist Church. This has been Elder Dan Sammons preaching in one of our regular meetings. Come and join us as we worship God in the simplicity of Christ every Sunday morning at 416 North Hall Street in Donaldson, Arkansas. At Harmony, we don't have many things you'll find in the popular churches of our day, but we do have a successful Savior. We invite you to come and see.